Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live au naturel from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's Fukushima irradiated so much that everybody now has a part-time job as an energy saver light bulb. And my very special guest is, I believe, John Carapat, who's a New Zealander, coming at us live from Australia, where he's on a wee bit of a trip trying to spread the word about GMOs, GE, and all of those other terrible companies that you just don't want to hear about because they are the spawn of Monsatan. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I hope you're enjoying yourself already.
Well, I love the music and I liked your intro, so hopefully the conversation will be as good as that beginning.
It's guaranteed. Now, if you wouldn't mind, please elaborate as to who you are and what it is you do.
Sure. I'm the national spokesperson for GE Free New Zealand in food and environment. My name is John Carapiet, and I've been involved in the GM debate for over 10 years now. And as the national spokesperson for GE Free New Zealand, the reason why the organisation is actually called GE Free New Zealand in food and environment is because I think over the long period of the debate in New Zealand and elsewhere, there's some real clear lines in the sand where people feel comfortable or more comfortable with the new science and the ways it's being used, and less comfortable, or in fact, completely objecting to it. And I think those lines are inside and outside, so that once it's in the open environment, a GMO cannot be controlled and impacts everybody in that environment. Whereas in medical uses inside the lab, for example, although that's not ideal, microorganisms are used and genetically engineered to make insulin that diabetics use. That is a medicine, and GE is used in medicine. And I think in containment for individual treatments, the issues are different. But outside in the open environment and in our food, the issues are quite clear. And I think so the dividing lines for me are inside and outside, and food and medicine, which are kind of like slightly arbitrary, but I think are good ones to guide us through a reasonable process forward for using the new technologies, but moderating extremism, extreme risk-taking, and enforcing acceptance of the technology onto the public, onto farmers around the world.
You mentioned extreme risk-taking. Is it your opinion that these risks are being taken by accident because of ignorance, or on purpose because of scumbaggery?
A really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, one doesn't want to be too cynical about the motivations behind big companies' behaviours, but there's clear evidence.
One might argue it's not possible to be too cynical about it.
Well, exactly. I'm sure that one could argue that. There's a lot of evidence to show that companies like Monsanto, not just Monsanto, but as you mentioned them at the beginning, companies like them are using every tool in the book, including lobbying, I would say, well beyond reasonableness. Basically, there's a revolving door in America where people who've worked for Monsanto and subsequently overseeing Monsanto applications are leading up near the top of the agricultural governance in government. So there's conflicts of interest, you know, all over the world, but in America and in New Zealand as well. So I think you could then say also that the evidence has been really clear for quite a few years that they cannot contain GMOs, they cannot stop contamination from happening. And yet the push is to say, well, okay, well, everyone has to accept that contamination, even if it's only 1% or 0.5%. And I would say that was unreasonable. And the fact that they take that stand that says we're actually going to force everybody to accept global contamination of the food chain, I would say is a strategy, not an accident.
Mm. Well, one must admit that these things are going on. How many farmers are currently having the land taken off them by Monsanto because Monsanto brand corn infected their fields? And they come in and they take their farm because, oh, you're stealing our patented biotechnology.
This is, I mean, I guess the thing to keep in mind is it's all driven by money. This is about money, 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 and control. So the patented seeds that you mentioned just now have been basically piggybacked over on a millennia of seed development by farmers and growers around the world that has developed basically the crops that we use today and have done for quite a few decades. But the GE trick is to genetically engineer them so that, one, you can patent them, and two, in the main, you can either spray them with patented herbicides or you basically build in an insect-killing protein called BT, which is also integrated into the plant. So both approaches are basically a basis for claiming a patent on the seeds. And then once you own those seeds, and what's happened in America, but also in other parts of the world, is that farmers who use those seeds need to sign a contract that says they will not grow them again and will buy new seeds each year. So there's a very clever mechanism being built in, which says, now in the West, actually farmers do buy seeds quite a lot each year, but certainly in the developing world, there's a long tradition of saving seeds and replanting them for the next crop. The patenting is a mechanism to stop that. So basically stopping that cycle of grow seeds, plant them again the following year, grow seeds, plant them again the following year. And it says, no, you had to buy our seeds. And if you keep the seeds, and if you try to grow them, then you're breaching patent and we will sue you and come and claim off you. Or, and this is, I guess, what you were referring to, there's been incidences in Australia and in America, many. Percy Schmeiser, I think he's a Canadian farmer, is another classic example. And if you Google Percy Schmeiser, you will come across his story. He was a soy farmer who had developed his own seeds but was accidentally contaminated by the next door crop of GM seeds, was then subject to what is going on, as I understand, in America, basically, you know, in inverted commas, secret agents going onto the land, testing the crops, saying, oh, these are our crops, not your crops, or at least you've got some GE elements which are ours, and therefore you either have to destroy your crop or pay a patent fee. And Percy Schmeiser is the best example of someone who said, no, that's not acceptable. You've contaminated my crop. I haven't stolen yours. And he went all the way through multiple layers of court cases. And as I understand, it was ultimately vindicated. I mean, almost.
But of course, that wasn't highly reported, was it? And also there's there's a little scratchy noise on your line, like a microphone rubbing on a beard. I'm not sure what that is.
I can try and pick up the thing. Is that better?
That's better.
Cool. So, yeah, funny enough, the Percy Schmeiser story has been quite, well reported over the years because it's been such a long-running saga. But as I say, the end game may have not been well covered, but ultimately his rights were upheld. And there was another, it was a parallel, it's not about food, but it was another parallel decision, I think, in the Supreme Court in America recently, whereby this whole idea of patenting genes, patenting naturally occurring genes, like the breast cancer genes, the genes that have been linked to breast cancer, and I think, again, an American company, I think its name is Myriad, basically claimed ownership of the naturally occurring gene that seems to be linked to breast cancer in women, then developed a test, and because they patented the whole gene, and it's thousands of human genes, as I understand, being patented, any test for the breast cancer gene is something that requires a license fee to be paid. And this has been going on for quite a few years. And just recently, I think the Supreme Court in America said, no, hang on, you can't do that. You can't charge people to test for a naturally occurring gene just because you patented that naturally occurring gene. So there's been a bit of a good piece of good news there. But generally, what's driving this is patenting genes and claiming ownership of naturally occurring, or rather piggybacking on naturally occurring plants and animals that have been developed over thousands of years. And that's a huge problem, because it's sort of like privatizing the commons that we all rely on to live.
Well, as Penny Bright, a noted anti-corruption activist in Auckland, said, the root cause of corruption in many cases is privatization.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the privatization of the global food supply, and using, and I guess, and it gets worse, it's not just the courts that can be used to control patents, but one of the things that has been a big issue globally and continues to be, although it's hard to say how much this has been actually developed or implemented, but things like Terminator technology and Terminator genes or Terminator seeds is the name given to seeds that, again, companies like Monsanto have basically committed to develop, to control patents. And these seeds will not grow unless you apply a certain chemical to activate them, or they will not grow at all after one generation. Actually, the Terminator seeds are the latter. So they grow once, and then they terminate their own progeny, in effect, so they cannot be regrown. And again,
They should perhaps more likely be called suicide seeds, because as we've seen in India, so many farmers have been committing suicide, like in record numbers, because of these Terminator seeds that they haven't been able to pay for.
Well, just on that, exactly. It would be evil to allow Terminator seeds to be used anywhere, actually, in the world. They're a crime against humanity, in my and other people's opinion. But it is something that they've been pushing. The India scenario isn't, as I say, it's very unclear as to what extent Terminator genes have been developed effectively or being applied. But what we do know is that this whole patenting and promotion of seeds to farmers, especially in the developing world, but even in the Western world, I would guess under false pretenses. So in India, there's been quite a lot of history of basically promoting, not always GM seeds, but basically hybrid seeds, but seeds that require inputs of chemicals and fertilizers that are also bought by the farmers. They're promised an increased yield and a better life. So they buy these seeds and they plant them, and there are technical issues with those seeds. There's actual pressures from the environment that cause them to fail. And in India, what that has resulted in over many, or you know, more than a decade, is that people get into debt to buy the new magic seeds. The seeds do not deliver the promised benefits, and therefore they don't have the crop to sell. Therefore, they're in huge debt, and therefore thousands, we're talking about tens, hundreds of thousands of people have committed suicide in India because of debt, not just about GE seeds, but more about the chemical processes and fertilizers and the expensive seeds, whether they're GM or not, that have been promoted to them.
And we've seen the effect on the soils this is having on a number of different farms all over the place. The land is dry, cracked, contaminated from all of these chemicals that are being used to grow these GM seeds in the first place.
Well, in America, I think America's a really good case study in a bad way, I'm afraid, because they've, you know, the Americans have been sold this, you know, large majority of American crops like soy are GMOs now. And what's happened is that all the promises that were made a decade ago or more, and all the worries that people like myself and scientists who I work with and talk to have said, look, these are issues you've got to be considering before you go ahead with this. All of those things have been ignored. I mean, can I just take you back right to the beginning? The FDA, which is the American organization governing these sort of things, or one of them, at the very beginning of the journey, we're talking about early 1990s, their scientists said, look, you've got to regulate these GM seeds and plants because they're not exactly like the ordinary plants we've been growing for thousands of years, or even the ones we've been hybridizing for a few decades. These are new because of the way you change the genes and the genes that you're changing. Those scientists were ignored because of politically appointed seniors who said, well, no, we're not going to go with this. What we're going to do is say they're substantially equivalent to conventional food. So first of all, the safety of these foods does not really need to be investigated. If you want to investigate it, you can. If you want to do a few weeks testing or a few months testing, please send us the data you've got, Monsanto. But essentially, they sort of deregulated the safety oversight of these seeds. Similarly, in terms of the farming of these seeds, they went into the market. They deliberately have bought companies all over the world, actually, not just America, so that the option to buy other seeds is slowly being reduced. So farmers have to buy these seeds. And then the promise to the farmers, and it worked for a while, it seems, is that they could plant these seeds, and then if there was a weed problem, they could spray the field with Roundup or some other similar chemical, or in fact, more and more chemicals, and I'll explain that in a minute. But the idea was you could spray the weeds, spray the fields, get rid of the weeds. The plants, because they've been genetically engineered to resist Roundup, they're called Roundup-ready crops, wouldn't die, and therefore you'd have a nice clean crop, weed-free, and there you go. Now,
and it's all contaminated by frickin' Roundup, which causes cancer and goodness knows how many other disorders.
So at the time, they increased the residues of Roundup allowed in food by 200 times. Since that introduction of those crops, what's happened is the weeds have become resistant to Roundup, not to mention the Roundup going into food, not to mention, as you just have, the impact on soil microbes and the impact on gut microbes in animals and humans eating these foods, not to mention those, we might come back to that later. But what's happened is the weeds have become resistant to Roundup. So the companies have said, oh, we'll develop some new improved GE crops that are resistant not to
Roundup. We caused the problem, and now it's gone out of our control. So what's the solution? Another big problem that we're going to create. Hold on one second there, John. We're just coming off to break now. John Carapace is my guest, ladies and gentlemen, from GE Free New Zealand. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Show. We're going to be talking about resistant weeds now. John, please continue. This is quite compelling.
Well, thanks. So what the promise to the farmers was is that you can use these GE crops and could spray the fields with Roundup and the weeds would die and you could get your crop and don't worry about the fact that everyone's going to have to eat it. And with the increased contamination of the glyphosate, just you'll have an easier life as a farmer. Now, that's turned out to be a complete lie. Number one, just so you know, there has been independent studies by a man called Benbrook looking at the production in America versus, say, Europe, where GE crops have not been widespread. And the production is not increasing. So the promise of GE feeding the world is absolute rubbish. The promise that farmers would have an easier life has also turned out to be absolute rubbish because the weeds became resistant quite quickly. The mechanisms that were argued around how you'd use these and manage these plants, they were completely unrealistic. There was plans to have refuges. These were actually for other kinds of crops, like the BT crops. But the idea that the farmer would plant half the field in the GE crop and the other half in a non-BT crop so that the insects wouldn't become resistant. But that's a slightly different kind of GE crop. The ones that are herbicide resistant, the weeds have become resistant to the herbicides. So what the companies have done is started stacking genetic resistance into the crops so that the crops can be sprayed with Roundup, but also other chemicals like Buster, it's actually quite an old chemical with associations to Agent Orange, but a product called 2,4-D. And 2,4-D has been used in things like, you know, golf courses to try and, you know, keep the grass down. But now, because the weeds have become resistant, multiply resistant, they've created multiply stacked genetic crops that can be sprayed by all of these, by all and any of those three sprays, which means the plants absorb it, which means that we then eat it. Now, you would think that when they were introducing crops that can be sprayed with Roundup, Life and other things like Buster and 2,4-D, someone somewhere would do some safety testing. Not that we wouldn't guess the outcomes, because they'd probably be not reliable anyway, but someone should do some testing before our governments approve such foods to be imported into New Zealand and Australia.
What we're now doing at our house, John, is we're soaking our fruit when we purchase it in the sink with some water and some vinegar, and apparently that gets away a lot of the herbicide and pesticide residue.
That's a great idea in general. The problem with GE crops is that the whole plant is able to absorb from the root upwards into the very essence of the product. So soybeans that have been sprayed with all these chemicals will, I'm afraid, still contain them, even if you wash them before you cook them up. And similarly, other products. So these particular way that they're genetically engineered, and because they absorb it through their life at any point in their life and survive it, it means that it's more integral to the product itself. And certainly BT, which is this, just to explain, Bacterium thuringiensis is a naturally occurring soil bacteria with lots of different varieties, by the way, and one of them or some of them kill insects. So in fact, different ones kill different insects. So what they've done is they've taken different kinds of BT and engineered them into crops so that the plants pump out their own insecticide, or not herbicide, but insecticide, to kill the attacking insects. And what happens is that, and what has happened is that over a few years, enough insects don't get killed off by that pumping out of the BT to develop resistance, and then obviously breed, and therefore you have a population of resistant insects to the BT, and therefore some crops, like I think the rootworm is a particularly bad one for corn in America. And what they found is that the insects have started to eat them. They've started to eat the bloody crops that were supposed to be killing them off because they've developed resistance. And so, and again, the BT is integral into the plant. It's not just on the surface that you can wash off. It's part of the plant's makeup. And in both instances, both in Roundup Ready crops and in BT crops, they have found that these chemical structures from the food have ended up in people's bloodstream. So there was a recent report earlier this year in Europe where Friends of the Earth showed, I think it was about 17 countries, they tested people's blood and found the residues of Roundup in people's blood. And a couple of years ago in Canada, they tested the blood of pregnant women and their fetuses, and they found the remnants of BT in their bloodstreams. Now, this may or may not be a problem. I believe it is a problem, but you can find scientists for government who say, well, you know, so what's that mean? You know, we don't know that that's harmful, but I would say it's not a good thing. The number one issue for Roundup is that it is virtually an antibiotic. It will kill lots of actually particularly good bacteria in our stomach or in the stomach of animals, and it allows some bad bacteria to thrive. So you've got this disturbance of bacterial populations in the gut of humans or animals or soil, And it's giving rise to new problems. There's actually a new organism, a microorganism that seems to be associated with GE crops and Roundup. There's obviously the impact in the stomach of animals, so that you'll get increased incidences of diseases like botulism, actually. We had a recent scare in New Zealand about botulism, which turned out not to be the case, it seems. But there was a number of scientists and vets putting forward a view that actually maybe they should be looking at the feed that the animals were getting, because in New Zealand they've started to, I'm hoping they'll stop, but they have been importing GM feed from Argentina and America to feed the cows. And when we had the botulism scare, there was suspicion that what if it's because the feed we've imported to give to our cows has caused the destabilization of the bacteria in the gut of the cows and allowed botulism to thrive. As I say, it doesn't seem to have been the case, but it does seem to be the case internationally and overseas, where, as I say, the BT and the Roundup have an impact on the naturally occurring bacteria in the gut of whoever's eating them. And that's a huge issue because, of course, it's only a fairly new science, but the science of epigenetics shows that, you know, there's lots of complex relationships between genes, between and our bodies and our environment in a very mobile, kind of complex, almost, you know, like a flow of effects, completely determined by what's just happened before, the environment the organism's in, and that one gene does not mean one protein. And this goes to the very heart, as I mentioned earlier, the EPA and the FDA scientists were saying, hang on, genetic engineering is really clever, it's very complex, it's very experimental, actually, and we should be testing and researching these before they go to market. They were side steps onto market.
Could I ask you, in your personal, professional opinion, are these foods weaponized?
I think they could be, and I don't think they've been actively weaponized. I mean, it depends on what you determine as a weapon. If you think, if it's a weapon of economic supremacy, yes, absolutely. If you're talking about a depopulation agenda, or I think there's easier ways to kill people than these, but it's definitely about control and ultimately control of the food supply and restricting access to natural open source seeds and creating monocultures and industrial farming as the way of producing food. And that would be, it may not be a weapon, but it'd certainly be a crime, because we know from the research done by the United Nations under the International Assessment of Science and Technology for Development, which is, the acronym is IAASTD, and I'd recommend anyone who's really concerned about feeding the world and helping the future of our planet to look at the summaries of that report, the IAASTD report from the United Nations a couple of years ago, and it shows how we will increase yields, how we will farm into the future to feed the population, and how we can do that sustainably. And none of it is to do with GE.
Are we talking permaculture here?
We're talking permaculture. We're talking about mixed farming. We're talking small-scale farming. Next year is the year of the family farm. The weapon, if you wanted to talk about GE crops, the weapon is against family farming. It's against small-scale mixed farming. It's against open-source seed sharing seed saving. It's against all those techniques and technologies and approaches, complex systems approaches, organic farming. It is an attack on those sustainable approaches that will feed the world, and therefore you could argue that it's certainly a war of sorts for the future of feeding the planet, because the yields have not gone up with GE crops, the chemical use has gone up, and the control over seeds and what all that means are basically the opposite of what the scientists, the independent scientists, are saying is the way to feed the world. And yet the government and big companies are pushing the former, not the latter. So that's the issue. We know how to do what we need to do to make our world food systems resilient and sustainable and fair. And yet the agenda from government and certainly companies is the opposite of that.
Can you ask these people why are you doing this? I mean, because I understand that the questions that people would want to know. You know, why are they doing it? We know how, because they're genetically manipulating things and so on and so forth. And we also know how that all of these progressive pieces of legislation get passed in favor of major, mega, evil agribusiness, because, well, basically the government's funded by them and most of the heads of their alleged protection agencies and so on and so forth are like former CEOs on Satan or something of that nature. They've got us by the short and curlies here, don't they? And it would take a, well, pardon the pun, a grassroots movement in order to outgrow this kind of phase that humanity itself is going through.
Well, I think you've named it. It is the grassroots movements that are happening and have been happening all over the world that must be quite amazing to these companies. They have got so much power. They have got so much, as you've mentioned and I mentioned earlier, they've got their insiders in the regulatory authorities. The governments are either stupid or misled or naive or driven by a profit agenda. I mean, a classic example of this actually is in New Zealand, where the argument for how we can reduce our intensive farming, the damage from our intensive dairying, by genetically engineering the cows or genetically engineering the grass that they eat, the rye grass, or doing something rather than look at how we actually farm them and maybe we have more organic and permaculture type approaches. Rather than any of those solutions, they're pushing the investment in R&D and then the intellectual property, the IP, and the profit to be gained by developing this magic bullet solution. All of that is, they believe, is a reasonable approach to economic development. And the fact that a corporation then owns those seeds for rye grass that's been genetically engineered to reduce methane in the output of the cows, all of those things seem to be logical because it's R&D and it's a technological innovation and it's a patentable product that you can charge people to use. So why wouldn't you do it? Well, let me answer that. I can tell you why you wouldn't do it, because what it does is it ignores the actual solutions that we actually know will address these issues. And it's not just farming more sustainably generally and not intensifying the dairying on land that can't carry it. But one of the things that's come up is that Massey University over the last few years tested different kinds of ryegrass, and they worked out that if you don't use a monoculture, one type of ryegrass, but if you use a mixture of different kinds of grasses, then you will reduce methane production by about 20% and improve yields and animal health. And the only reason, in my view, that that is not being adopted immediately all around New Zealand is because you can't patent it. It's a natural, it's basically about thinking your way through a problem, not trying to find a magic bullet. So that is a classic example where actual solutions are ignored in preference for an agenda of R&D, intellectual property and control, because it's commercially driven. And I think that is a very typical parallel, has its parallels in all the other mechanisms. It's about profiting and control, not about actually addressing global issues.
Well, namely because it seems to fall into the Hegelian dialectic of problem, reaction, solution. David Icke called it the totalitarian tiptoe. You create the crisis, then when people call out for a savior, you are all too happy to save them by, of course, giving yourself more power and control.
This, I think, going back to the grassroots resistance comment, I think this is one where they may not win. I mean, of course, the battle's still going. It's been going on for a long time, but it carries on going. And I think they must be surprised. The powers that be that wanted to force Europe to have GM crops still haven't actually got there. In New Zealand, we have no commercial GM crops or plants growing at all. Yet in 1998, they were planning to release GM wheat all the way through the South Island. So the resistance, I mean, there was a campaign, I think, resistance is fertile. The resistance is enormous all over the world. Even last week and a few months ago, hundreds of thousands of people marching against Monsanto in different marches around the country. In America, state upon state have tried to get labeling of GM food because most Americans want it. 90% want GM food labeled, mainly so they have a choice to avoid it.
Indeed, John, we're going to break now. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, because now we're learning that New Zealanders are Roundup resistant. We'll be right back.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment of the first hour. It's unfortunate that I've only got you for 1 hour, John. I presume you're very busy. I'd love to have you for second if you'd be up for it, but I don't want to put any pressure on you.
Let's see if we can keep going. Well, I'm not sure how much longer I've got for that second hour, but certainly let's keep going and see what we have remaining to cover. I mean, the trouble with this subject actually is that it's so overwhelming. There's so many different aspects. So let's carry on. But
well, can I make a point based on that? This is one of so many subjects that we cover on this show that, like you say, are incredibly deep and overarching and so absorbing and overwhelming. Ergo, a soundbite is just not enough. And this is the format that I prefer right here that we provide on American Freedom Radio, with long segments so you can actually express incredibly sized quantities of information compressed into only a couple of hours. And this methodology that we have with mainstream media, on the other hand, is quoted as being the "and now this" phenomenon, because that allows you to forget about what you've previously heard. If you do the test with somebody, you sit down and you watch the news, and after the news is over, you ask them to recite as many stories and as many details as they can. Even if they manage to recite every story and every bit of detail, they'd still be missing a huge quantity of information. I believe Mark Twain once said that those who read only newspapers will be less informed than those who read nothing at all.
Well, that's a very clever predictive observation, isn't it?
It just shows that the problems that humanity is suffering today have been problems that we've been suffering our entire existence. And I think now, with the information age, it might be the very first time that technology has allowed us the ability to communicate in long form with large quantities of people, so that we may not repeat these mistakes of the past. For now, we have the information available to stop them from happening right now, if only people would listen and expand their attention span.
Exactly, and find the time between getting the kids to school and, you know, going to work or whatever else they're doing. So it's a very challenging situation. But going back to that grassroots resistance, I mean, I think the technology, like the internet, like this conversation we're having now, and lots of other things, just people thinking more sensibly about this can't be good for me or my kids. There's a huge resistance around the world to GMOs in the food supply, particularly. And I just wanted to, like, carry on talking about that, as we have got some time. So what we were talking about before was the resistance in America. So you've got grassroots campaigns in almost every state, as I understand it, but certainly currently in Washington, last year in California, where votes have gone on to ballots whereby people are saying, we want GMOs labeled so we know what we're eating and have a choice to avoid them. Now, in California last year, that vote went initially pre-voting, the support for that motion was about 75%, something like that. By the time millions of dollars had been spent by the industry to say, oh, don't label GM foods, it will add cost to your foods, it will be a heyday for lawyers, you'll be confused, oh, don't do it. Enough money was spent to frighten people that the ballot was actually lost by, I think it was like 51 against labeling it, 49 for labeling it. So it didn't pass. But the momentum behind that battle has continued. So I think currently in Washington, there's an attempt to get labeling. It's going to go through in terms of the vote in the end of this month, or end of November. And again, the same thing's happening. Millions of dollars being spent either directly by companies like Monsanto on funding a campaign, or surreptitiously by food companies in America, not wanting to be seen to say, oh, we don't want to label it, but giving money to the grocery manufacturers industry association who are funding this campaign so that the actual brands are hidden. But there's lots of websites in America where people can find out which brands to trust and which brands to avoid. There's a huge development. One of the fastest growing categories of food in America is the GMO project or non-GMO project, which is it's a nicely designed little label that thousands of products are now carrying that shows that companies are trying to keep GMOs out of their food system. And that, as I say, that's the fastest growing sector in America. But in other countries, the resistance is huge. In New Zealand, even though it's gone a bit quiet, it comes and goes. But we still have no GM crops, as I mentioned earlier, even though the plan was to have them all over us, I think. We are now marketing ourselves more and more as this clean, green, sustainable, ethical producer, which is completely not 100% pure now, but needs to be to live up to that. And I think there's a real momentum in the public and in our export markets to say, well, that's the only reason why we buy your food, guys, is because it is supposed to be clean and green and grass-fed animals. So let's start living up to that.
What is it currently at, 12% pure, New Zealand?
Oh, I think it's higher than that, but, you know, and growing.
Like 14?
Or at least.
I look at our water drinking water standards, and we're allowed, I think, 1,000 times more triclifer, which is the one of the active ingredients in Roundup, I'm told to believe, than under European drinking water standards. Why is it the Europeans are allowed to, you know, not have fluoride and not have pesticides contaminating their water? Yet we're supposed to. I mean, it feels almost like we're a third world colony. Oh, wait a second. Yeah.
Ah, well, you named it. But I guess, I mean, it's a paradox that the main reason why we've got an image, and of course that 100% pure thing was a tourism campaign. But I think, unfortunately, for those who don't care a damn about the people or our environment, it's resonated with people globally and in New Zealand, so that now it has become slightly bigger than it was ever intended to be. It's obviously completely untrue and actually probably impossible for anyone to live up to, but it's become an aspirational goal that a lot of New Zealanders certainly embrace, and they do know that we're not clean. I mean, they probably don't know quite how unclean we've become, but because of our low population, we're still potentially able to deliver, I would hope, more organic produce out of our land, more sustainably, ethically produced food out of our land. Now, I might be wrong. I don't know what's been done in New Zealand that's, you know, the hidden underbelly of, you know, and we stumble across it periodically. We find out, oh, no, a chemical company called Dow dumped some barrels of poison in that land a few decades ago. So we are finding things out that are less than ideal. But anyway, that's a journey that we continue on. But overseas, other countries also want clean, safe food, you know, potentially bought out of New Zealand, but potentially not, potentially produced locally. So the American farmers have been sold a pup. As I say, a large amount of the corn and soy is GMOs. The problems are now really clear for many of them and it's causing problems. And I think that there's going to be a shift in America, even though it is the heart of the drive for GMOs in many ways. Even there will be a shift. But in other countries, in India, we've talked about the Indian farmers committing suicide, as I say, not just because of GM seeds, but just the hybrid seeds that have been sold to buy expensive inputs, chemicals, fertilizers. But the Supreme Court of India appointed a technical expert committee, I think it was the year before last. They reported at the middle toward the end of last year, and they were sent away to rethink their report. And I'll explain why in a second. And then a few months ago, they came back with their final report and their final recommendations. The report, the reason why they were sent away, I think it was October last year, they were sent away to rethink their report, was because their initial report called for a 10-year moratorium, that is to stop GM in India, because of a number of reasons, ranging from conflicts of interest in governance through to the inability or lack of capacity to regulate these products, to even know to test them, the absence of any animal feed testing to show that these foods were safe. These reasons were given in their initial report, delivered to the Supreme Court, and immediately industry said, oh, no, you can't stop GMO. We've got to feed the world. We've got to feed the poor, blah, blah, blah. So they came out with the usual arguments. And so you know, basically the Supreme Court had to send these experts away and say, you know, can you look again, please? You know, wrong answer, almost. But last, I think about 2 months ago, they came back with their final report. They've called for an indefinite moratorium on GM in India. And I'm talking about releases and approvals of foods that are being allowed without any testing. They've said all and the conflicts of interest with government being compromised and governance being compromised by the companies and their interests. So all of those things have gone, and the Supreme Court of India is not to be trifled with. Now, they haven't confirmed, and the government certainly hasn't adopted the recommendations of that report as yet. But the resistance to GM in India, and Greenpeace is very active there as well. But there's also a woman who I've come across, and I hope your listeners will look up, a lady called Vandana Shiva, who is a spokeswoman for particularly rural women and the development, a recognition of women being the backbone of certainly the developing world's farming communities. They've been very, very resistant. And I would love to come back later on to golden rice, but we'll talk about that. But golden rice is another product that's been promised to help the world. And Vandana Shiva is very good talking about golden rice. But
we're going to be coming back from break in another 5 minutes or so, John. We're also going to be joined by one of the world's leading journalists and researchers, Suzanne Posel from OccupyCorporatism.com, who's, I think, in one of the top 11,000 websites in the world at this particular point with their articles. And we're going to add her to the discussion with you, John, and talk about GMOs and all of these other particular things that are really bad for people's health at all hours of the day. We're practically bathing and saturating, as well as gestating damn near everything that a chemical could love. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guests, Don Carapace, Don Carapace, and it sounds like some kind of Italian mafioso slang term. How do you actually pronounce your name, John?
It's Carapace.
Carapace.
I'll answer the variations on the theme. I'm fine.
but it's much better to do things correctly, because that way you get remembered correctly. And Suzanne Posel as well from OccupyCorporatism.com. Welcome to this little panel discussion, Suzanne.
Hello, everyone. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Now, John, you wanted to talk about Mexico.
Well, yes. So the theme that I'm trying to sweep through generally is this global resistance from the public, from mums, dads, consumers, from independent scientists, from growers, to GMOs being enforced as they are being through different mechanisms like trade agreements, for example. But Mexico, the history of Mexico being the origins of maize, the center of all the diversity of that crop, and yet even though they banned it about a decade ago, it turned out that some imports from America, some seeds being given away to a few poor farmers, or whatever mechanisms, they found contamination of the original variants of or wide varieties of original maize crops in Mexico. They found they had been contaminated the GM versions, even though at that time GM had been banned in Mexico. Anyway, a big saga that includes independent scientists being harangued and attacked for revealing these sort of facts and having their whole academic standing undermined for speaking out, having found out these facts. And that's another story. But just recently, the Mexican, I think one of the courts in Mexico, has also repeated a ban on GM crops in Mexico because they're finding health impacts and obviously farmers are finding their crops being contaminated for a long time. So the resilience, the resistance is happening there. It's happening in India. It's happened in Europe and continues to do so for decades. It's happening in New Zealand and Australia and America, even though, as I say, the poor Americans have been sold a pup. The farmers have been sold this magic bullet solution that's become a nightmare. The public have been denied the right to avoid it, but are now waking up and demanding that right. So the resistance is really strong. And I think at the same time, the science is coming out. It's really coming home to roost. And I just want to quickly highlight what that is. So there's no long-term testing of these foods. If you remember from my comment earlier, what happened was the scientists at the FDA were ignored by the bureaucrats, and they said, and the bureaucrats said, no, what we're not going to test these new complex GM foods. We're going to assume they're substantially equivalent, substantially the same as conventional food, and we're sort of going to be rubber stamping them. And that was then adopted globally as an approach in food safety authorities in Australia and New Zealand, and to some extent in Europe and around the world, to follow my lead. Now, that has changed. In the last year, independent scientists led by a scientist called Seralini, Eric Gil Seralini. And if you look up Seralini on the internet, you will find his work. He was also attacked enormously for going public with his findings. But he did the first two-year lifelong study in rats of GM's impact. GM sprayed with Roundup, importantly. So he was testing the food that we are being fed or our animals are being fed around the world. And in 2 years, he identified significant problems ranging from, and these problems have also occurred in other tests, but ranging from tumor growth to cancer to loss of fertility, et cetera, et cetera. Now, his findings were enormously attacked globally immediately they came out by people who didn't know anything about them, probably hadn't even read them. One of the things he was attacked for was that the test rats, and I'm not supporting animal testing, by the way, but in reality, that's what we're talking about here. But the animals that he used are a particular kind of rat that have been developed to grow tumors. They're basically they're model experimental rat, poor little things, but that's what they exist. And he was attacked for using these rats because they, of course, they're going to develop tumors. That's what they've been designed to. But the same scientist attacking Seralini didn't point out that these are the rats that are used in the standard tests, and that even Monsanto, in its like month-long tests, which it doesn't have to do, but sometimes does, sometimes doesn't do, its month-long tests use these rats. So there was a lot of attack of Seralini on various fabricated sort of like charges, in effect, to try and dismiss his work. But his was the first ever long-term, lifelong animal testing for safety of any GM product ever done anywhere in the world. It was also peer-reviewed and published, and it found problems that need to be pursued. And what has happened is that Europeans have now adopted a very similar approach to what he did for their food safety testing of GM food. Meanwhile, New Zealand and Australia have done bugger all, and they haven't done any of those improved techniques to test, and therefore we're still flying blind following the Americans. But the fact that the Europeans have adopted this rigorous testing is good news for Europeans and for the world, because it's starting to show that, I guess we never mentioned this, but the biggest issue around GMO, apart from this pursuit of control of the world food supply and et cetera, is the hijacking of science itself. The subversion of sound science of a new technology like this that will probably happen with nanotechnology, but basically the rush to market, the rush to profit, the rush to control by corporates at the expense of actual science itself. And there's lots of independent scientists who've become afraid to speak out on GMOs. Seralini is an exception, but he's come under enormous attack. But his work shows that it's been a farce, this whole safety testing and regulation globally over the last decade. We've got the problems in the farms. And as I mentioned earlier, the technical expert committee in India, the Supreme Court's panel appointed, they said very similarly that they didn't mention Seralini, but basically you need lifelong tests of these products using animal models as a first step to assess their safety. And none of that's been done globally. And that's the farce. That's the jack up. And that's why whenever you hear, oh, there's no scientific evidence. And of course there is scientific evidence. You're listening to somebody either spouting Monsanto's words.
Oh my God. Reality. I have noticed that phenomenon so much. Oh, there's no scientific evidence. There's no scientific evidence that, and they use the exact same line with intravenous vitamin C, fluoride, GMOs, chemtrails, every single thing you could conceivably think of that is really going on, and we've actually got the science to prove it. That's the line they use. There is no science to prove it.
Because they haven't done anything. But of course, that's what's changed, is the science is emerging. And Seralini is a great example. I personally spoke to a scientist from the UK over a decade ago, which got my interest going on this, although I was obviously already concerned. But I called a scientist called Dr. Arpad Pushdai. And Dr. Arpad Pushdai was a world-class geneticist working, I think he'd even worked for Monsanto in the past, but he certainly worked in genetics. And he was being funded by the government of the UK and I think other companies to do a test on rats using a GM potato. And when he came out, and this is like in the late 90s in the UK, initially, he was given a high profile on the media. Yeah, listen to this program tomorrow night on BBC to hear about what's happening in our food. He went on air and said his science, his testing showed that either the way we move genes, and that's a whole other subject, but there is reason why there's scientific argument about it, but the way you move these genes or the genes that you moved caused tumors in the rats or problems in the rats. And after a day of that, the phone call apparently went from the American president to the prime minister of Britain, and Dr. Arpad Pushdai was fired. His unit was shut down. All his data was confiscated. They said he was mad and old and doddery and got it wrong. And it took another 2 years of independent battling through the courts to get his data back. An independent scientist saying, no, he was right. His research needs to be followed up. And of course, it never was.
You do understand that this is a global phenomenon, don't you, ladies and gentlemen? Doesn't matter what country you're in, if you're hearing this information from GE Free New Zealand or GE Free America or GE Free Canada or Mexico or whatever the frank country you could think of, this is happening everywhere. That's how big and influential this company is. It can literally buy a government. Have any idea what kind of dangers can be perpetrated on the public with a company that is capable of purchasing somebody's government, purchase laws to be passed in their favour? They can have a monopoly on force. And indeed, recent food bill legislation in New Zealand here purports that they will allow private contractors, i.e. Monsanto employees, to come onto your property without a warrant to check your gardens, and they're armed, they can be at least, and here's the kicker, they're immune from any criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. Did you know that Monsanto owns what was formerly known to be Blackwater, the world's largest private army? We're not talking about just giving you cancer. We're not talking about just taking the farms. We're not talking about just subverting the entirety of the legislative process to push our own ends. We're not talking about just the control of food. We're talking about control of humanity and their access to it in and of itself.
It's a dark one. Can I just mention a couple more things before Susan might want to join us on this conversation, but the TPP agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which America is part of, so is New Zealand and Australia, but the TPP is currently being negotiated in secret, apart from a few mentions in the media that is going on. And it, again, raises big issues along the very lines you've just talked about, Vincent. It's basically about corporations being able to direct the regulatory system and governance in individual countries to benefit themselves, not the public interest or the local government. And that includes potentially, I mean, this is the big debate around the GM element of the TPPA. Potentially the agreement will say, if America gets its way, you can't test GMOs, you can't label GM food, and you can't not grow it. And if you don't let us grow it on your land, we're going to sue you through the disputes tribunals, and you'll have to pay us compensation for not growing our GM crops. Now, that is the worst case scenario, unfortunately, vaguely realistic as a potential attempt by the TPPA when it comes out into the public eye. But my argument would be, no, America, listen to your public who want 90% or 95% want it labeled, GM crops labeled. Extend the labeling and testing and make it more robust in our own country, but extend it to all the members of the TPP, including America. So you must label GM crops. You must test GM food, and you don't certainly don't have to grow it. In fact, you hold people liable for growing it who cause damage. Now, those rules are the kind of thing that we should be fighting for if we want the TPPA at all, which is debatable. But that's what I would see as reasonable content for moderation of the risk-taking for GM. And in New Zealand, just so you know, the whole system about GM in New Zealand is that it's subsidized by the public, not just in R&D, not just through basically subversion and stroke corruption of our governance through vested interests, but literally by the law that says if something goes wrong with GM in New Zealand, as long as the company doing it had been approved to do it in the first place by the regulators, which they always do get, and hadn't broken any of the rules, and the rules are like nothing, the public will pay. It's called socialized risk, and it's applied to nuclear accidents and to GM. And the reason why it's applied to GM, to allow it to go on, genetic engineering is being subsidized by the public with a full subsidy, risk-taking by corporations is being encouraged and subsidized because the insurance companies won't cover it. The insurance companies will not cover long-term, slow-moving damage, which is the kind of thing that genetic engineering will absolutely cause. And therefore, to enable it to happen, the governments have said, oh, the public will pay. The public will subsidize it. And in New Zealand currently, local councils from Auckland, Northland, Whangarei, I think out in Hawke's Bay are also looking at this. The councils are saying, well, hang on, our public do not want this, our farmers don't want it, our export markets don't want this. So how can we stop the government? And the central government in Auckland and New Zealand, I mean, is pushing GM as a next magic bullet development for the economy. How can we stop this? So they've been looking to prohibit companies from growing GM in their local areas. And now our government, Amy Adams is the Minister for the Environment, she's now saying, oh, we're going to change the law, which is the Resource Management Act in New Zealand, to change the law so councils cannot stop it. Now, again, this is a big battle. We're continuing to battle our central government, who are basically pulling the agenda, and local government is also now fighting them to say, no, this is not good for New Zealand, it's not good for our public.
All right, John. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today. Suzanne, do you have any final comments for him? Oh, actually, sorry. John, could you please give us out your website?
Yeah, it's gefree.org.nz, so gefree.org.nz, and the other one that I would recommend would be something like gmwatch.org, which is, I think, a global site, and they're really rich in resources to follow through to Sierra Leone, to what's happening in Mexico, to the tests on pregnant women in Canada a few years ago. All of it is on GM Watch and, as I say, on gefree.org.nz.
Thank you very much, John, for your time. Now, we've got about 30 seconds before going to break. Suzanne, would you like to give us a rundown about what you're going to be mentioning in the next segment?
Well, we're going to be talking about whether or not you are a debt slave.
We were just talking about debt slavery and debt killing people in India, weren't we, John?
Exactly.
Yeah. Haven't you noticed how everything's connected in some obscure, little, inconceivable way? Yet it's inextricable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We live in an opposite world. Don't you wonder why that is? Maybe it's because the people who control this world have the direct opposite intentions of what you would had you their power. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break with Suzanne Posel. Thank you, John Carapiet from gefree.org.nz and gmwatch.org as well. Back in a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Suzanne Posel. Suzanne, you have some information for us. Take it away.
Oh, my gosh. So, which 60,000 Americans are considered modern-day slaves? And that's up on OccupyCorporatism.com. According to the Global Slavery Index, did you know that they had a Global Slavery Index?
I thought they called it the stock market.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's a good one. They published a report stating that 75% of the world, which translates to 29.8 million people, are considered modern global slaves. The overall tone of the report...
I'm sure that's just a conservative estimate.
I'm sure it is. But here's the funniest part. You're going to love this one. The overall tone of the report asserts that with more governmental oversight, stricter laws enforced, and political overreaching control, the threat of modern-day slavery can be abolished. Come on. Come on. You know they're going to say that.
Can you explain what that actually means? I mean, if that's their statement, what's the actual real truth of the matter?
Well, Big Brother is no longer this icon. You know, it's actually in your house. And what you were speaking with your guest prior, where people can, the new laws that you have in place, where people can walk onto your property, make an assessment, they could be armed. There's no recourse. You don't have any right to privacy. Here in the United States, we have a Fourth Amendment right. That would be revoked completely. The Fifth Amendment right, the right to not incriminate yourself, would be revoked. It's being revoked right now with the NSA collecting all the metadata. So the only way to cure global slavery, according to Global Slavery Index, is more of this tyrannical one world government kind of scary 1984 Brave New World and a little bit of we have never heard of this yet stuff.
So let me get this straight. If a minority of people are technically classified as global slaves, then that's not okay. But if a majority of people are classified as modern day global slaves, then that's actually what is good, because by comparison, it's much better because everybody feels like, I don't know, they're all friendly, they're together, and we're all slaves, and thank goodness for that.
Absolutely. And you break this down. In some countries, one out of 25 citizens are considered an indentured servant. In America, although the modern slave rate is estimated at 0.02, that estimation still translates to 5,000 U.S. citizens being indentured servants, and the entirety of the definition of slave that the Global Slavery Index gives, 60,000 Americans now fall under that category. So just because you see a little percentage, 0.02% of Americans, it seems like nothing. But it actually translates to 60,000 falling under the definition of slavery, which includes people forced into labor, prostitution, child soldiers, child brides, as well as indentured servitude, and humans as chattel under absolute ownership.
What is the definition of an indentured servant that they give on the survey?
They just lump it in with that whole thing. But indentured servitude is what we had with the feudal system back during the Dark Ages. When you were given a piece of property, as long as you worked it and you produced from it, you were able to live on it. But if you didn't follow what the Lord wanted, or the crops didn't yield the way you wanted it to, or for whatever reason, the sun came up and he fell out of his bed because he got shocked or, you know, had a bad dream that day, he could kick you off the land and you have nowhere to go. And including all of the work that you've done, you're not paid for, and you have to return all of the spoils. So you have nothing.
By that definition, you're sitting in a place that you have to keep paying for and have to keep earning money to pay for. And as soon as something bad happens to you and you don't have the money to pay for it, you're out on your ass. Is that what an indentured servant does?
Uh-huh. Ask the people who got foreclosed on.
Well, I mean, it's even broader than that. Does anybody listening to the show right now pay rent? You know?
Oh, yeah, people don't realize that you're the people who own the property that you're renting from, even these large corporations that own many different rental units or rental complexes, if they go bad on their mortgage, you get kicked out too.
Well, and of course, if you don't pay your rent, you get kicked out as well. So it occurs to me that loosely, a decent massive percentage of the population are indentured servants. Even those who own their homes and are not mortgaged at all still have to pay taxes and rates and so on and so forth on their homes. And if they don't pay that, they get kicked out. So it occurs to me that there isn't a soul alive in the Western world that isn't in some way, shape, or form an indentured servant. There's no such thing as a non-indentured servant, only degrees of it.
Sure. And in another study, the cause of the problem was identified. A Swiss federal institute put out this study last year. The report stated that 40% of the world's wealth were contained in 147 corporations, which form a super entity. And these include Barclays, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, UBS, Deutsche Bank, Morgan Stanley, Bank of New York Mellon, Bank of America, all the people we know and love. And they control 40% of the world's wealth. So when we look at the indentured servitude that's going on, we look then and say, okay, well, these 147 corporations, including banking institutions, because they are corporations, are in control of all of this wealth. So since the global economy is based on consumerism and creation of consumerism, which is the creation of more products, you have a perfect recipe, like a little crock pot for indentured servitude.
And do any of these institutions actually produce anything of real wealth or value?
No, and see, wealth, people don't realize what the word wealth means. That has been defined in our culture as far as a social meme and social consciousness. Wealth is not the digits that you see on your balance in your bank account. Wealth is the attainment and the retainment of actual items that retain their wealth and continue to grow in wealth as the years go on. In other words, families who pass down property, things of value, you know, items and antiques and things like that. That's what makes people wealthy. It's not how much money you have. It's the things that you have that are worth something.
That means manufacturing. That means growth from seed. That means inventions. Gambling is not a form of wealth creation. It's a form of wealth displacement, because the house always wins at the end of the day, doesn't it? What were they talking about extracting with carbon taxes, for instance, Suzanne, extracting the wealth of the West to the third world, and so everybody becomes equally poor?
Well, sure. So you have a country in Africa, like Africa, you have, the whole continent. Let's take the whole continent of Africa. And most of the people are not using nuclear power or that kind of energy. They don't have access to electricity in their homes. So they're not producing as much pollution as developed nations. So developed nations need to pool into a fund through the carbon taxing to support a kind of counterbalance these emissions, and they sell the emissions in blocks. Global Management LLC, which is the company that Al Gore owns, he sells carbon taxes, and they sell them in blocks to people, and they trade them on the stock market. And basically, it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing that they're trading. But they're going to then implement the government's tax the people to fund this entire scheme.
I always find it amusing, the words that they use. For example, in New Zealand, we had the emissions trading scheme. I don't know if people realize that a scheme's not a good thing, especially when it's being pulled over you.
Sure. Well, it's the same thing with science. It's been accepted that the word theory means fact, but it's not. They have a bunch of theories. Some of them are evidentiary, based not on the theory itself, but things going around it that make the theory assumable to be, you know, to be truthful. But it is still a theory. It's not a fact. So they apply that ideology to what we're discussing here. And people think that, you know, opinions are facts, theories are facts. Control the language, you control the mindset of the people. You can do whatever you want to them. They don't realize that it's being pulled over their eyes.
They think theories are facts, and they think facts are theories. Oh, that's a brilliant scheme.
Sure, because if people are not educated, then they don't know what to think, and they trust somebody else to bring them their prepackaged information.
Do my thinking for me. Please do some thinking for me. I'm going to accept that I'm an idiot and I don't have any clue how to make up my own mind. Unfortunately, I don't actually do that. I just accept what some person tells me and allow them to do my thinking for me. And if somebody else comes along and tries to do my thinking for me again, but tell me the opposite of what that other person is telling you, I'll only believe the official source, because, of course, only official sources can be correct. Only official sources tell the truth.
Sure. And the only criteria for being an official source is that entity's declaration that they are an official source, or that they are telling the truth.
And indeed, there is legislation being passed in the United States now, correct me if I'm wrong, to license journalists so that it will eliminate all people from reporting on news or whatever with blogs and so forth if they're unqualified, unregistered journalists.
Uh-huh. It is. On OccupyCorporatism.com, you can read about it. It's called the Federal Media Shield, and it will essentially federalize the entire press. And so if you have to fall under these criteria in order to be protected by the First Amendment, which the First Amendment does not state that there are any stipulations that necessitate your coverage under it. It's just there. It says that you have the right to free speech and the press and to redress your grievances in a public forum, yada, yada, yada. So it's called the Free Flow of Information Act, you know, and it is slated to define what a journalist is, the conditions by which you can be a journalist, a covered journalist, which was an amendment added in because originally Dianne Feinstein wanted it to just say journalist, and they said, no, well, we need to narrow this down because otherwise it's not going to get passed. So it's a covered journalist who is an employee, independent contractor, or agent of an entity that disseminates news or information. And that individual would have to have been employed for 1 year within the last 20 to 3 months, within the last 5 years. And it would apply to student journalists or someone considerable with a considerable amount of freelance work that can be proved within the last 5 years, leaving federal judges to go ahead and murky the waters up even more by granting privileges to a journalist if they decide that they fall under covered journalist for whatever reason.
Oh, no. You know,
yes, and it gets worse.
When basic freedoms go out the window, I mean, like privacy, for example, I mean, I don't know how people rank them. Maybe this should be a rank and file, like this is a very basic freedom, and this is kind of an extraordinary freedom, something that you're, it's amazing that you're allowed to do. It's very basic to be able to say what you want, right? Very basic, I think. Mm-hmm. If you take that away, it doesn't matter what other extraordinary privileges you think you got, because you got nothing.
Absolutely. Now, the definition does not include any person or entity whose principal function, as demonstrated by the totality of the person's work or entity's work, if they've published anything but primary source documents that have been disclosed to such person or entity without authorization. So, people who report on news that's being reported are not journalists. And that actually covers a large majority of the alternative media.
Except it doesn't cover the Vinnie Eastwood Show, because we normally don't follow the news, ladies and gentlemen. What we do is we have on people from around the world, activists and so forth, who you wouldn't hear in the news at all. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Big Monkey Wrench. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's all about jamming a big fat monkey wrench into the gears, levers, and wheels of the scumbaggery apparatus of the New World Order that threatens to crush all of us within its grinding gears of absolute servitude, domination, poison, toxicity, and deception. Welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Your break, your reprieve, your island in the sun type radio show. You should be drinking a cocktail while listening to these fastest 2 hours, ladies and gentlemen. And bear in mind, if you want to know whose fault it is that this show exists, you need only look into a mirror, because this show is entirely supported and funded by listeners like you, so we can get out the information that is so important that, of course, mainstream media won't freaking touch it. And this is a terribly unfair scenario. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I've had both very fair things happen to me and very unfair things happen to me in my life. And I don't think that I should just stand by and let unfair things happen to good people. Not when I can do something about it. Not when I can provide them a forum where they can speak their piece, tell the truth, and try and help their fellow man in any way they can. So please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And donate today. Or make a little $5 a month donation automatically, either into the bank account or through PayPal, in order to support this broadcast as we expand and grow both in size and scope. Suzanne Posel is my very special guest. Welcome back. What was it you wished to cover in this final segment that was so urgent?
Well, the House stenographer said that the Constitution was written by Freemasons. Diane Foster Reedy was the, or still is, the stenographer for the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C.
And what is a stenographer exactly?
They have a they have a little machine, and they type into it, and it's a complex set of codes that they know what it means. It's like a very complex form of Morse code. Yes. Yeah. And so it's got little symbols on it, and they learn what it means, and it's a very, very short way to get all the information. It's in courtrooms as well. So she was on the floor. She grabbed the microphone, and she said, "It never was. It never had been. The Constitution was written by Freemasons. They go against God. You cannot serve two masters." And as they drug her away, she said that God will not be mocked. And what I found interesting was immediately there was a conspiracy scenario quickly brewing about the question of whether or not Diane Foster Reedy is the name of the woman that they drug off the floor. So I did a search because they're coming up with this other name, Holly Eskridge, and this is because of a solicitation that was found on biz.gov concerning the office of the clerk for the House of Representatives, which Diane Foster Reedy is a stenographer for that office, and she would work there. However, when I checked the website for the office of the clerk, the name Holly Eskridge did not come up. There were no results found. Curiously enough, the same is true for Diane Foster Reedy. So it's possible we don't know what that woman's name is. But it's not Holly Eskridge. Now, what I found interesting was what she said, whatever her name was, actually has a very good historical basis in truth. In France, from 1779 to 1781, publisher Benjamin Franklin was the Grand Master of the Freemasonic Lodge in Paris. And at the time, he met Thomas Paine, a young Englishman who was expounding on the streets of France, trying to kick off the French Revolution. And Franklin convinced Paine to write his philosophy down, and his ideology has come down to us as the pamphlet Common Sense. And so Franklin was integral in bringing Paine to the 13 colonies to give them common sense in the hopes that it would spark off the Declaration of Independence, which common sense does suggest is the only way to break off from the crown. And so it did. And so it was. And so here we are. And there you go.
My favorite Thomas Paine quote is, "It's a patriot's duty to protect his country from his government."
It is amazing, and I've had people say, "Well, so what if the Constitution was written by Freemasons? It was a good document," and that's true.
I think that's actually the main point to come away here from the Constitution. The problem with the United States is not its Constitution. The problem is it's not being frickin' followed.
Yes, that is the problem. And it's because of the constraints that our current president has from the founding fathers, that he can't just write laws, that he has to go through Congress. It's so constraining.
And there's a reason for that. It's because if somebody's able to take over willy-nilly and just change everything in whatever way they wish, it means your way of life would never be preserved, and it would just change entirely from one president to the next.
Sure. And we have, interestingly enough, I brought up this fact that there was a leaked video on YouTube that showed the inside of a lecture room where the presenter was discussing how the U.S. Armed Forces were currently experimenting with vaccines to control human behavior, specifically religious fundamental tendencies. And we've seen a lot of people...
So they're creating a vaccine against spirituality.
Taking that fundamental ideology that fires off the neurons and excites, you know, the person, and using that to a specific end or a directed end.
Would one think that a world without any form of religion, any form of belief, morals, ethics, and many of the doctrines that were the reason why the revolutionary United States even was capable of happening, because all the parents were reading the Bible to their children and instilling these morals and ethics into them and so on and so forth. Not a lot of child illegitimacy, high moral standing, low crime rate, 10% growth in the economy every year for like best of 100 years. You've got to be freaking kidding me.
Oh, sure. And then there's a circulated video from FEMA where they're training agents on the Founding Fathers, explaining that they were terrorists who began a war with their British benefactors. Isn't that an interesting way to put it?
That's the only way to put it, because I found that if you have love for your people or your country, the best way to get you to betray them is to misinform them about who they are and where they come from, and to see the truth in a very different light indeed. That
well,
way,
sure, they-
you have no loyalty to that which actually bore you, and you wind up only having loyalty for the thing that's trying to destroy everything that gave you your life and your liberty and your personal property in the first frickin' place. And you simply become a part of the machine, an apparatus that takes all of those things you value and cherish off of everybody else, and then eventually yourself, because you're just expendable and they can just take you out. And then history shows, of course, those who usually help the dictator or prospective emperor into power are often the first to die after he seizes said power, because he feels threatened and he knows that only the people who are his closest friends and guardians know what a lying scumbag he is and can take him out at any opportunity.
Sure, it is the mirroring, like you mentioned, of seeing, hearing, what, listening to what you want to hear, and then producing that for you to gain loyalty toward that person's, because once you have a personal investment in something, you're more likely to defend it and go through with it and go along with it. If you're not personally invested in it, you're like, oh, that's happening over there, that doesn't affect me, so it's, I don't care.
People don't care in a lot of ways. You've heard of the monkey sphere, how we have about 1,000 or so personal relationships, varying from distant acquaintance to very close friend. Very close friends, usually only a few people. Then, of course, the family, usually only a few people. And all the rest are people that you met and maybe could remember the names of if you got reminded of them or something like that. If somebody within that 1,000 people, what you call your monkey sphere, dies, there's a direct impact on your emotional ability to function. There's actually a real effect on your life in some way, shape, or form, depending on how far down the scale of acquaintance to very close friend or mother or father you go. Anybody outside of that monkey sphere dies, there is virtually no effect, okay? I tell you, your mother just died. Instantly, your whole world falls apart. Conversely, I tell you that 1 million Iraqis are now dead because of the US invasion over the last couple of years. And there's nothing. Ladies and gentlemen, ponder that for a moment. While you think about how you care about the people around you, maybe should be extended to include many, many more within your little monkey sphere. Because if we don't care about each other unless they're very, very close to us, how are we actually going to stick together when those who are leading us are indeed our greatest enemies? Suzanne Posel, OccupyCorporatism.com. Thank you very much for your insights today. And ladies and gentlemen, you have yourself a very, very nice evening indeed.